You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, welcome to all of you to the Open Society Foundations, and welcome to what is, for this year, the inaugural event of this kind. The Open Society Foundations is, together with the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, supporting a series of publications, working papers related to issues of security in Central Eurasia. And today's event marks the launch of the first paper this year in this series. And we're very fortunate to have with us today the author of this paper on external support for Central Asian military and security forces, Mr. Dmitry Gorenberg, who, among other things, is a senior research scientist at the CNA, which is a non-for-profit research and analysis organization, editor of the journal Problems of Post-Communism and of Russian Politics and Law, an associate at the Harvard University Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies, a writer, a blogger, an expert, one of the foremost experts on Russian and former Soviet military affairs. And he's written a truly excellent paper, which you can find online at the website of SIPRI, S-I-P-R-I. I think one of the first paper that I've seen that really brings together a huge amount of extremely useful information related to foreign military and security assistance to Central Asia, and I think it will be a very valuable resource to anyone working on this issue. But also a paper that raises a number of very important policy issues, which Dmitry will be discussing today. Also joining us is a familiar face to many of you here at the Open Society Foundations, Scott Horton, who also works in a variety of capacities. He is a contributing editor for Legal and National Security Affairs at Harper's Magazine. He's an attorney at DLA Piper. He's a lecturer at Columbia University. He's also... for many, many years was the chair of the board of the Central Eurasia Project here at Open Society Foundations, someone with a very also deep knowledge of security and human rights affairs in the former Soviet Union and in many other parts of the world as well. So we are extremely fortunate to have him with us today. I think that's, I won't say much in terms of preparatory remarks beyond that. Just a couple of points. First of all, this event, as you may notice, is being recorded. Secondly, as I'm sure you can hear, we're dealing with some construction issues across the street, so just be aware of that. This will probably be going on through most of the event, unfortunately.
Think of it as a murmuring brook.
That's right. It's, after a while, it gets kind of soothing, but trust me. We've been dealing with this for a couple of months now. But anyway, I think without saying too much more, then I'd like to hand things over to Dmitry. I've asked Dmitry to speak for around maybe 20, 25 minutes or so. Scott will respond with some comments and some ideas for further discussion. At which point, I think we'll open things up for a question and answer and discussion. So, Dmitry,
thank you. So, as a drawdown of foreign forces from Afghanistan has accelerated in the run-up to withdrawal by the end of 2014, attention has really come to focus on the extent to which military equipment will be left behind for the use of Central Asian states. And at the same time, over the, deals have been made in recent years to extend Russian military basing agreements in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan. And these have highlighted the extent to which Russia is providing military equipment and other forms of security assistance to states in the region. So these two situations together raise some questions about the actual extent of external support for military and security forces in Central Asia and the potential impact that augmentation of these forces could have on regional security. And the issue has become, I think, especially salient in recent years as all these states have started to increase their spending on military and security forces, which has in turn led to a gradual increase in capabilities, still just to different extent in different countries, but the trajectory has been more towards reviving forces than it was in the previous, let's say, 20 years. So the report, which I urge you all to look at if you haven't, gets into a lot of details on capabilities, on specifics of what kind of equipment has been provided, what kind of training cooperation goes on. I'm not going to get into the details too much here. I'm going to focus more on kind of the general trends and some policy recommendations that flow from that. But the report does cover not just Russia and the U.S., but also EU states, China, and some other countries as well. So it's a fairly broad attempt to cover everybody who's trying to do something in Central Asia to the extent I can. So let me just start by talking about Russia first. And Russia remains the main source of military and security assistance for most of the Central Asian states. Russia's primary goal in the region is to keep Central Asia in Russia's sphere of influence, and at the same time making sure that U.S. and NATO forces leave the region after the completion of the Afghanistan operation. So there's sort of two sets of countries. There's the sort of the weaker Central Asia states, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, where Russia provides military assistance. And this can, I think, best be described as kind of a quid pro quo arrangement, where Russia is providing political and military support for the ruling regimes in these countries in exchange for basing rights and a certain level of acquiescence with Russian foreign policy priorities in the region. Then there are the sort of what I call the buying countries, primarily Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan also to some extent. And these countries, because their militaries are in large part equipped, they're Soviet legacy forces, so they have Soviet equipment. They're still largely following Soviet military doctrine. So for them, the Russian weapons are the most familiar, the easiest to acquire. Their personnel are familiar with Russian training methods. So that's kind of the first direction of buying weapons is Russia. It also helps that because most of the countries are members of the CSTO, these countries pay lower the Russian price essentially for military equipment, so they kind of can get it at a discount compared to what they would have to pay elsewhere. So the report goes into, you know, as I said, a lot of detail on what exactly is provided, and the finding is that this assistance, while significant for the region, is actually relatively limited in scale in the overall sense. But given the low starting capabilities of Central Asia's military and security forces, even relatively limited assistance can have a sizable impact on security and stability in the region. Now, going forward, I think the impact's likely to be somewhat mixed in terms of how this plays out in security relations. On the one hand, efforts to improve counterterrorism and counterinsurgency capabilities of these states are likely to help local armed forces protect their countries from the threat of infiltration by radical Islamist groups, for example. But on the other hand, the extent of the danger to Central Asian security from these kinds of this kind of infiltration has repeatedly been overstated, both by local leaders and by the Russian partners. In large part in order to justify assistance requests and subsequent security cooperation. I would argue that most local leaders actually face greater threat from internal instability and perhaps in some cases even regime collapse, as we've seen a couple times now in Kyrgyzstan, than from outside infiltration. I think the events of the Arab Spring and the 2011-2012 electoral protests in Russia highlighted this for the Central Asian leadership. So regime stability is really their highest security priority. And since Russia provides equipment and training to security services without much regard for how such assistance might be used, it's quite likely that any enhancements and capabilities could then be proved to be useful for helping local leaders protect themselves from popular protests that may happen down the road, and by repressing internal opposition movements. So that's kind of the big picture on Russia. Let me turn to the U.S. a little bit next. So for the U.S., ensuring continued access for supplies and personnel to Afghanistan has been the highest priority in Central Asia for much of the past decade. There have been other goals, to counter terrorism, counter narcotics, democracy promotion, preventing WMD proliferation, and these have been pursued over time as well, but only rarely have they been allowed to infringe on the priority of the Afghanistan mission for the U.S. Now, in terms of providing equipment to Central Asia, the U.S. track record is actually kind of poor. There hasn't been that much provided, but what there has been provided, a lot of the equipment was largely wasted because of inadequate maintenance or lack of training in their use on the part of the local militaries. So that's there are a lot of kind of rusting ships and this unused helicopters in various countries in Central Asia. The other point that I want to make on this is that given that we're in a period of reduced budgets and limited resources, the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is going to result in a decreased emphasis on all forms of assistance to Central Asia. The region's going to once again, as it was in the 90s, become a relatively low priority for the U.S. Department of Defense. Now, security assistance budgets for Central Asia have already been cut in recent years and are most likely going to be cut further in the years to come. Now, we may, given the recent events, we may be entering a new period of confrontation with Russia, but I would argue that that's not likely to change this equation very much, because the primary focus for the U.S. in this potential confrontation is going to be on Eastern Europe and the Caucasus. So Central Asia may get some residual effects, but actually, I think the larger trends in potential trend in increasing assistance will be to Ukraine, to Georgia, perhaps down Moldova down the road. So I think that's kind of where things are headed. And Central Asian leaders sense that this withdrawal period kind of presents for them a final opportunity to receive significant amounts of military assistance from the U.S. The countries that are most interested in such equipment are Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. By contrast, Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan have the financial wherewithal to buy new equipment on their own and have not appeared very interested in donations of used armaments from the U.S. or from elsewhere. Last year, there was a lot of public discussion about the extent of potential U.S. assistance as part of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And a lot of the media coverage was really overstated, both the amount and the significance of the equipment that's likely to be provided, and also the potential impact of such assistance on regional security. So the research for this report was completed last fall. And at that time, at least in open source materials that I had access to, the U.S. government had not agreed to transfer any excess defense equipment from the Afghanistan operations to Central Asian states. Now, it's possible that some equipment will be transferred through the EDA program at some point, but even if it is, it's not going to include major weapon systems or probably even small arms. So it's going to be more like trucks and kind of logistics equipment, that sort of thing. So the security consequences of these donations is likely to be relatively limited. Now, what I argue in the report is that the greater threat to regional security is posed not by the potential provision of military equipment from NATO forces leaving Afghanistan, but by some of the longstanding U.S. training programs for the region's special forces, which are conducted as part of an effort to increase counterterrorism preparedness. Now, the U.S. has a wide range of training programs for Central Asia, and some of them are quite useful. There are areas such as language training and reform of how the military is structured that are quite helpful. But I'm here specifically talking about the special forces. So in recent years, special forces troops trained by the U.S. military have engaged in combat against local insurgents on several occasions, and also have fired on unarmed protesters and other civilians in Tajikistan and in Uzbekistan and possibly in Kazakhstan as well. And what's more, these training programs are generally much less costly to donors than equipment donations, so they're much more likely to be maintained as part of general U.S. military assistance programming after NATO leaves the region, even though the overall resources are going to be lower. It's just easier to maintain those kind of programs. So that's kind of the problem with the U.S., and I'll come back to this a little bit in the conclusions. Let me talk just briefly about the European Union. While the EU and its member states have been particularly active in efforts to improve local capacity in counter-narcotics and in border control, and it's been primarily carried out through the OSCE. Second, the European defense industry has become the preferred alternative for Central Asia states that are seeking to diversify their sources of military equipment, particularly Kazakhstan, as a country with the most resources and the most desire to kind of develop a more modern military. Kazakhstan has set up numerous joint ventures with various European defense firms, especially in areas such as aircraft and helicopters that they're building in Kazakhstan under license from Eurocopter and other companies. What the European Union states have not done very much is provided direct military assistance. So there have been training programs in those border control and counter-narcotics areas. There have been some sales, but not providing equipment as aid very much. Also want to cover China briefly. China's role has been very interesting because it's very limited, but China's very significant from kind of a strategic point of view. So China generally lets Russia take the lead on security and military engagement in Central Asia. And Russia's willingness to bear the burden of maintaining regional security has really allowed China to free ride on Russian investments in Central Asian security. China's been involved to a very limited extent, and when it is, it's very careful to go through the SCO rather than doing anything bilaterally with individual countries on the security side. Again, this is a security side. The economic side is obviously very different. Local rulers are also worried about China's rapid entry into the region and don't trust China's long-term intentions, and this has contributed to Chinese calculations to stay out of Central Asian security for now. However, I would argue that China is set to allow Russia to continue to play the dominant role in Central Asian security while China focuses on developing economic ties and securing needed energy resources for itself. But this may change if the security situation in Central Asia deteriorates, especially if Chinese leaders come to feel that Russia is not up to maintaining security in the region. In that case, I think that China would step up security assistance programs to ensure that its investments in the economic and energy spheres are protected. But for now, they're happy to let Russia do that work and just invest in the economic sphere. There are a few other states that are involved. Turkey remains one of the primary providers of military equipment and training for several countries. They're providing aid primarily to Kyrgyzstan, while Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan are targets of efforts to develop commercial ties by the Turkish defense industry in a number of areas. The Turkmenistan Navy, armored vehicles in Kazakhstan, night vision equipment, so a fairly broad range of kinds of equipment. India is also involved. It's tried to make an effort to hedge against China and Pakistan, its traditional rivals in the region, by seeking to establish a military presence in Tajikistan. Although when that effort ended up having very little success, they refurbished an air base that then they were not allowed to actually use. And since that was a few years ago, and since then India hasn't done very much, in part because they kind of felt the sting of this rejection, in part because they want to avoid antagonizing Russia. So, and finally, Israel, which has played a surprisingly large role in providing security assistance to the region. And this is consistent with Israel's long-term effort to build security partnerships with those Muslim states that are willing to work with it. And Central Asia is particularly important for Israel because of its proximity to Iran. So it's quite happy to develop partnerships there. And the existence of a community of immigrants from the region living in Israel has helped to establish contacts and to some extent to build trust. It's also helped to, in some cases, it's led to some fairly corrupt activities that have turned into big scandals. But nonetheless, that's sort of how the connections have been made. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a very quick overview of a 90-page report of lots of detail about different countries and what they're buying and what they're getting and so forth. Let me turn to some conclusions and recommendations, and then we can go on to discussion. So overall, the external military assistance to Central Asian states is, I argue, is unlikely to have a serious negative impact on regional stability and security in Central Asia. With the end of NATO operations in Afghanistan, the region's decade-long position of prominence on the international arena is likely to fade. In this place, Central Asian states are likely to be increasingly left to their own devices, with internal instability as the most serious threat that they face. While external military assistance to Central Asia is likely to decline in the near future, it's not going to disappear. And in this context, it's important to ensure that the assistance that is provided is not wasted, one, and two, helps to improve the security situation in the region. In particular, steps will have to be taken to ensure that any such assistance does not enhance the ability of internal security forces to harm civilians. And the recommendations that I have in the report flow from this understanding. So, number one, training needs to be emphasized over the provision of military equipment. Now, this is a lesson that the U.S. government has already learned to some extent, as it has in recent years shifted away from equipment donations towards providing training in areas ranging all the way from language instruction on the one hand to combat operations on the other. Shifting towards training will also help to avoid situations where the equipment that's provided is then used against unarmed civilians by local forces, resulting in embarrassment or worse for the country providing the assistance. And we have, I think, the most prominent example of this that I can recall in recent years was the tear gas canisters in Egypt that had, made in the USA on them that got a lot of attention a couple of years ago. Now, shifting to training is not going to entirely solve the issue of complicity and potential complicity in repressive activities, since the force, as I mentioned earlier, the forces that are trained through these assistance programs have already been implicated in some cases in human rights violations in Central Asia. So one way that human security could be improved is by shifting the focus of training programs from the special forces units that have been the primary focus to policing work especially teaching internal security forces how to handle large groups of protesters without resorting to excessive violence. And again, this depends on the country involved. I'm thinking, you know, Kyrgyzstan is a place where this could be especially valuable. Uzbekistan, they probably don't care so much overall on whether there are unintended casualties, or perhaps they are intended. So, but anyway, that's kind of, and I recognize that you know, as far as the U.S. government is concerned, that is complicated because if the assistance funding is coming from the Department of Defense, they're not allowed to aid police forces. It would have to come through the authorities of the State Department. But nonetheless, if we're looking at the bigger picture, and we don't have to be constrained by how the U.S. government operates. We should make recommendations on how the U.S. government should operate. So that's, I think, along the lines of where there might be some benefit. Second part is that as part of the effort to reduce the smuggling of people, narcotics, and weapons, both the U.S. and European security assistance has emphasized border security initiatives. And these efforts are very laudable, but they've often focused on technical assistance, such as donating scanners or other kinds of detection equipment to secure border crossings, also refurbishing border guard posts and that sort of thing. Now, such equipment may not be so useful when the bulk of the cross-border smuggling in the region is sanctioned either by local intermediaries with government ties or by the government officials themselves. So the scanner isn't going to do much good if, you know, everyone knows that it's going to be turned off whenever the right people are paid off. So now training can help to ameliorate this problem to some extent, but in the end, it's not really going to be solved without breaking the link between smuggling and high-level corruption. And that's a problem that goes far beyond, you know, training border guards and it's really, you know, how to eliminate corruption is, I think, in some ways the insoluble problem of not just this region, but many regions. But assistance providers have to recognize that given the local incentive structures, a lot of the corruption reduction initiatives that are in place are not going to eliminate corruption. And given the nature of local smuggling networks, providing technical assistance for border security in the present conditions can in some cases be a waste of money. And so that just has to be kept in mind when these programs are being contemplated. Now, a second set of recommendations in the report was that coordination among the assistance-providing states is necessary if the goal is to improve human security in Central Asia. So the effectiveness of a lot of security assistance is undermined by the perception among donors that other powers are providing assistance as part of an effort to increase their influence in the region. So this kind of zero-sum nature of competition, which is then encouraged by local leaders who play off outside powers against each other in an effort to preserve their own freedom of action, and in ways that Alex Cooley has set out in his book and others have as well. So in the report, I suggest starting with cooperation in areas of mutual interest, such as information sharing and multinational training in counter-narcotics, which is a real area where everybody kind of had similar interests. And then that could be expanded as trust increases. Now, given the recent crisis in relations between Russia and the U.S., who are the two main donors, and the EU countries as well, are in this as well, this type of cooperation is likely to be off the table, unfortunately, for the foreseeable future. But it's still, you know, I think worth keeping in mind as something to aspire to down the road when relations are restored and cooperation can resume. Now, these recommendations are deliberately quite limited in their scope. Security assistance efforts by outside powers are unlikely to lead to major improvements in regional security, given the perceptions both within and outside the region that these powers are engaged in this geopolitical competition for influence rather than a sincere effort to improve local conditions. And furthermore, the likely decline in attention paid to the region by outside powers after the completion of NATO's withdrawal from Afghanistan is going to reduce the extent to which outside powers remain interested in the region. So other priorities will inevitably make it more difficult for to change assistance policies toward the region. So recognizing all of these limitations, the relatively small steps I've outlined, I think, would help to improve the impact of outside military assistance on human security in Central Asia. So I'll stop there.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much, Dmitry. Scott, over to you.
Thank you, and thanks to Dmitry for this paper. I really think it's a superb product, well worth being read. Sorry we don't have copies out there, but that's the new policy, right?
Which that's
is
right.
Not the waste paper.
We're going
we want
green.
Everyone to
that's
go right. out and read it on and cyberspace instead. You should invest the time to do that. And I think it really covers all the bases. In fact, it makes my job a little bit more difficult because I was going to, I instantly thought when Michael first emailed me, fine, we'll just go dashing in and address those two old staples of the Open Society Fund, which are, first of all, the question of leave-behinds in, from the Afghanistan conflict, and concerns particularly that the Uzbeks are going to get their hands on helicopters and all sorts of lethal weaponry, which we know, of course, they dearly wanted.
Right.
And secondarily, the issue of training programs. Training programs focused especially on special forces units, but also police and I'd say paramilitary police operations. The fact of those programs against the background that includes the events in Andijan, Zhanozin, Osh, and so forth, and the risk not just of embarrassment to the United States, but going beyond that. But my problem is that Dmitry actually addressed all those issues, and he addressed them very well, and his prescriptions also, I think, cover everything that's needed. So that creates my dilemma. So I think I'm going to resolve my dilemma by saying, okay, all fine and good, Dmitry, but don't we have a sea change going on right now? And doesn't that really provide a reason for us to go back and revisit a lot of the questions you raise and ask if it's not going to affect them? Now, I think you somewhat preemptively said, no,
it was
not really.
My notes already.
No, not really. But I think it, and I think that's probably correct that in the area of security assistance, maybe not. But I think we should go back and we should look at all these things a little bit more consequently. What are the developments I'm talking about? Everybody knows what they are, I guess. No, we're not talking about the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. No, instead, it is, I think it's actually two separate sets of events that produce each of them their own set of concerns for governments in Central Asia. And the first is the events of Maidan leading to the toppling of the government. Well, let's say an extra-constitutional transfer of power to a new government. I mean, and a transfer of power that, no matter how friendly one wants to be to the people at Maidan, nevertheless, raises pretty serious questions of legitimacy, certainly serious questions of legitimacy that will persist until elections are orchestrated that can actually provide democratic legitimacy for a government in Kiev. So you have that set, and with most Central Asian governments being of an autocratic nature, not being really democracies, not even trying very hard, I say with the standout example, of course, exception of Kyrgyzstan, this presents obvious worries. I mean, worries, I can imagine people reading about this in Asta and Almaty thinking about Zhanozin and what was going on there, as well as other events. And then we have the second complex of problems, which is the Russian absorption of Crimea making it an actual part of the territory of the Russian Federation, the constitutive part, the subject of the Federation, which is, again, if we look back to what happened in 2008, the summer of 2008, a far more aggressive posture than was taken with Georgia, where you had the intervention, but even there, the posture was taken that Abkhazia was an independent state, right? I think one of the things that's going on is that that gambit didn't work very well for Russia. I think not followed by a lot of people, but followed by scholars of international law and diplomacy, the Russian effort, if you're going to be an independent state, you have to, well, international law provides these definitions. You have to have a territory, you have to have a government, you have to have a population. The reason why the Vatican really isn't a state, by the way. But you also have to be recognized by other nations. That's a requirement to be a state. So Abkhazia is being created as a state, and a Russian diplomat started scurrying around the world trying to find governments that would recognize Abkhazia. You know, Vanuatu, Nauru. I mean, and by the way, let's start with the fact that not a single government in Central Asia, not even Tajikistan, was prepared to say, yes, we recognize, not even Belarus for that matter, we recognize Abkhazia as an independent state for obvious pragmatic reasons of their own. So you had an assortment of tiny islands in the Pacific that did so after receiving considerable expressions of grace from the Kremlin. And I'd say it was a pretty embarrassing failure. And I think that experience helps us understand exactly why there was a move to a much more aggressive posture with Crimea, absorbing it directly in. But that also creates much more reason to be concerned on the part of all the Central Asian governments. And I think we have to view the situation between Russia and Ukraine right now as a work in progress. I mean, I would really love to think it's over now and there are no more territorial aspirations, but certainly there are clear reasons to be concerned about them. And in fact, the way that this has played out, I mean, especially focusing on media inside of Russia and how it's been sold to the Russian population very effectively for the time being, I would say, we have a lot of commentators saying it's exactly like Germany in the 1930s and the Sudetenland, and I suppose that's true, but actually this points to a staple of techniques that's been used by imperial powers going back a long time. So in fact, if you look at the way British India expanded vis-a-vis the princely states in the period between about 1870 and 1890, it's exactly the same techniques over and over again, constantly stating that, oh, the interests of British citizens or subjects in the principality of what's-its-name are being threatened. And the government there doesn't seem to be able to control the situation. And the government seems to have fallen into the hands of Hindu fundamentalists or Muslim fundamentalists or whatever. The same sorts of concerns being expressed over and over again, they would always proceed by a period of a couple of months, the arrival of British forces in to absorb that princely state into the Raj. So it's sort of a time-honored practice. And I think we see that going on now and raising obvious questions about the eastern and southern Ukraine. So what does all this mean for the Central Asian region? And I think it means it probably means quite a bit more than the events of the summer of 2008 meant. And I think there that sent sort of a cold wave through the region, but didn't produce mass shift and orientation towards either the West or Russia. But this has got to be viewed as a far more serious threat. I think if we look at the region, we're going to have to break the region up. I mean, by the way, one giveaway, whenever you hear someone running around talking about Central Asia, Central Asia, Central Asia, and characterizing the entire region, you know they don't know anything about the region. Because the instant you start sending it, you realize it's impossible in one brushstroke to describe this region in any way that really matters. But I think one of the clear dividing lines at the start is going to be between Kazakhstan and the rest of Central Asia. I mean, I keep thinking back to the phrasing that was used in the Soviet period where, in fact, it was always Kazakhstan and Central Asia. Central Asia was not Kazakhstan. Central Asia was something historically, culturally, much closer to Russia. You know, it was southern Siberia. It was included cities where Dostoevsky lived and wrote, for instance, right? Very substantial Russian population, Russian cities. I'm trying to think, if you even go back and look at the history of Kazakhstan, some of the capitals at some point were Russian cities.
Orenburg,
exactly. So there's clearly cultural, historical attitude which is blossoming in Russia today, including in state media and independent media. There's a different attitude towards Kazakhstan from Central Asia, and more of an attitude of it being a almost integral part of Russia, potentially, at least as integral as Crimea, potentially. So that presents an issue, and you have the very substantial Russian populations and the Virgin Lands in eastern Kazakhstan and the city of Almaty and other areas around the country, sort of discrete areas that are sort of ripe for breaking off or reabsorption. And I think this is going to present a real challenge for Kazakh leaders. Now, I think the same sort of concerns, we could even say maybe, is it wrong? Maybe, I don't like to say positive things about the government in Ashgabat. But on the other hand, they seem to have saw very early on, in the 1990s even, that having a large Russian population on your territory might raise all sorts of problems. And I think the Uzbeks, same issue, same problem. Notwithstanding, Karimov married to a Russian, certainly a Russian speaker, culturally quite Russian. Nevertheless, under his government also, there were policies pursued that sometimes subtly and sometimes not so subtly disadvantaged Russians and certainly encouraged them, sometimes quite aggressively, to depart for their homeland. So the result of those programs was that the Russian population in both of those nations was dramatically reduced. So that sort of vulnerability does not exist. But it also seems to me, if we look at this from the perspective of Moscow, we come to a question of, you know, how would Russia want to assert its interests in this region? And let's assume that we're even dealing with a Russia with imperial or neo-imperial aspirations, that's the correct characterization of Putin's Kremlin. It seems to me still quite a stretch to think that they would want to aspire to actual control and reabsorption of Central Asia, following the old Soviet distinction, as opposed to potentially Kazakhstan. And I think the one clear sign of that is if we think back to the Osh events. I'm blanking on the year now. When were the last
2010?
2010, of course, right in the wake of the Second Revolution. 2010, where there was even an appeal from Bishkek for support for Russian troops, for Russian peacekeepers. The answer from Moscow was no, and I think that was quite a considered answer. Mm-hmm. I think you know that there was a sense that this was not a desirable way for Moscow to exercise its control. In fact, instead, I would say probably the desirable model for control would be something like what we see in Dushanbe today. Which is an independent, ostensibly independent state, which nevertheless is effectively a protectorate of Russia that subjects itself in many, many different areas, but starting the list with security issues to consultation and agreement with the Kremlin. I think that most likely is the model. And then what does this mean for U.S. posture, U.S. cooperation. I mean, there I think Dmitry's absolutely right that we're going to see a shift in which the priority of security assistance drops precipitously. I don't see that these events are going to cause a change in that. On the other hand, I think it probably is going to cause a ratcheting up of pressure on the Central Asian states and Kazakhstan to limit their dealings with the American security apparatus, you know, most vehemently in opposition to having an installation of any sort. But I think also in other forms of cooperation, you know, listening posts and intelligence cooperation, all sorts of other things of that sort, I think Moscow is likely to be far more vigorous in the near future in opposing those things and figuring out exactly what's going on. So I expect them to be successful in that and to chill those relationships. But it seems to me, coming out of all that too, we've got another really very fundamental question, and that is the experiment of Central Asia as a set of independent states. And the fundamental question that hangs over this region is, are these states viable? And in fact, you know, when I read Dmitry's paper, that was in the back of my mind. You know, is he demonstrating that in terms of the way they deal with their own security, it's one of the most fundamental issues of any state, are they dealing in a way that really moves them themselves towards political viability, viability of states in the future? And what the answer I extract from that paper is generally no. I mean, maybe the exception is Kazakhstan, maybe. I mean, Kazakhstan really, you have to give them credit. There are lots of problems with the Kazakh state, but the Kazakh state does seem to behave very smartly in terms of construction of the basic edifice of a state, doing it in a sort of programmatic, policy-driven way, doing it with a reasonable allocation of money. And I think in that sense, the way they pursued defense policy is not much different from the way they pursued monetary policy. That is to say, it's much smarter than any of the other states of the region. But, you know, one of the fundamental questions for the region is about the region. That's something you actually don't talk about so much in your paper. It wasn't commissioned either. Maybe it should have been. And that is, can the states of this region survive without working together with one another? And there, I mean, and the answer seems to be they don't really work together in any way. I mean, not economically, but not even in the area of security, when there's every obvious reason for them to try to work together effectively. So I think that to me is sort of the final question. You know, can these states survive? And it seems to me we've got one state that does respectably and then another group that is, they're highly dysfunctional states, although each dysfunctional in its own unique way. But I think I'll end it with that and turn it back to Dmitry and see what responses you have.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Scott. So yeah, Dmitry, brief response from you on a couple of points. First of all, you did allude to the Ukrainian events in your comments, and obviously your paper was written well in advance of these latest events, but do you see this sort of this very fundamental realignment taking place, and what implications beyond increased difficulties for cooperation between U.S. and Russia, what implications do you see for the engagement of Russia and the U.S. in security in the region? And then, secondly, I guess Scott also raised a very provocative question on the viability issue. And I'm wondering, so maybe just limit to those two big points, then, because I do want to open it up for broader discussion.
On the first point, I think you know the $64,000 question for everybody is Putin clearly has some map of what his ideal Russia looks like. What we don't know is what it is, right? So clearly, you know, if we look to in the western direction, clearly it includes more of Ukraine than just Crimea, but probably not all of Ukraine. So that's you know, we don't know, does it include the Baltic states? Probably does in an ideal universe, but he recognizes the limitations. When we look at Central Asia, I don't know. I don't. I'm not sure it includes any of them, right? Even northern Kazakhstan. Second, Putin is much more of an opportunist than a strategic thinker, I think. So, unless Kazakhstan collapses in some unexpected way, at least to me unexpected way, I don't think he's really going to have the opportunity to do a Crimea scenario in northern Kazakhstan, even if he wanted to. That seems to me, you know, that's sort of how I interpret Crimea, is that it's, he may have wanted to include Crimea one way or another for a long time, but it wasn't like he had a plan to do this. But when events kind of spiraled out of control and Yanukovych was unexpectedly overthrown, he sort of took advantage of the weakness of the new the new regime and the chaos in Ukraine to go ahead and do this. So what does this all mean for Central Asia? I think that in terms of, you know, I don't think there's a major threat, at least for in the foreseeable future, of, you know, boundary changes coming, you know, from Russia. In Central Asia, I agree with you on the that they're likely to, there's likely to be more pressure to exclude the U.S. From the region. Although, I think there's going to be, at least some of the states in the region are going to resist that. I think both Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan are going to try to, even more than they have so far, try to keep their options open. Which will include trying to reach out to U.S., will also probably include trying to reach out as much as they can to China as well. Maybe I'll stop there on that point. And then the other point was on viability. I guess there's that question of what does state survival mean, right? What does viability mean? These states have been more or less dysfunctional for, you know, over two decades now. There are lots of states that have been persevering despite being even more dysfunctional for even longer, right? There are actually fairly few examples over the post-colonial period of complete state failure. You know, Somalia, Zaire, Congo, to a greater or lesser extent, Afghanistan at various points, now possibly Syria, but probably some others I'm forgetting, but not a lot, given the number of states and the number of really weak and dysfunctional states. So I think that they can muddle along for quite a while. The risk of, you know, conflicts among the states remains still, maybe we're ranging kind of far beyond our topic here, but the whole water conflict, the weak states provide the water to the slightly stronger Uzbekistan, right? And that creates tension that I think has been simmering for a long time and could, at some point, depending on how things develop, lead to a conflict. So I think we've been wrong already, at least on one occasion, where I think a lot of people thought that any regime transition in Turkmenistan would lead to chaos and instability, and that didn't happen. So, which makes me cautious about predicting similar chaos and instability in the eventual regime transition to come in Uzbekistan, but at the same time, it could happen, right? There could be elite fight, and it may be that a lot depends on how Karimov dies, right? If it's sudden, then maybe somebody can jump in, and whereas if he's sort of weak and incapacitated for a while, there's more opportunities for infighting. I don't know, but that's the kinds of things that I would be more concerned about than sort of the viability as such. So I'll stop there, and maybe we can have some questions.
Okay, great. We have just under half an hour remaining, so I will take questions. I would encourage people, when you're asking a question, please do identify yourself. So I see you, one, two. I'll take these in groups of three. So one in the back, two right here in the front, and three right over there.
Hi, my name is Sanjay Patil. I work with the public health program here at OSF. Scott, I like the way you sort of identified the fact that Central Asia as a region doesn't necessarily mean much, particularly given how diverse the countries are. So my question is specifically focused on Kyrgyzstan, but I'm sure it could apply elsewhere, but we'll focus on Kyrgyzstan because it's a country I know better than the others in the region. So on this point of viability versus legitimacy, I wanted to pick up on a point, Dmitry, that you mentioned in terms of corruption being like one of the key elements in the legitimacy of this state. So basically, my question links to Georgia. In 2004, with the Rose Revolution, because the police were so identified as a criminal enterprise, essentially, one of the major sort of platforms for reform was police reform. And they essentially fired most of their police and then rehired them with better pay. That has proven to have resulted in diminished corruption amongst the police within Georgia. I'm curious, with a small, relatively smaller state like Kyrgyzstan, whether something like that would be feasible, and if so, what would have to happen for that particular entity, which really does speak to both the viability of a state and the legitimacy of a state. If the police and the political apparatus are so corrupt that no one really respects them as an institution, cleansing it would require a significant change in the way business is done. So I'm just curious if you could comment on that.
Okay. So I'll take the questions first, then get you.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about the Eurasian Union, Putin's concept of the Eurasian Union. He had Belarus and Ukraine and Kazakhstan in that union. Now, how far east is that union going to go in his mind? I guess my question is, will it include the Central Asian republics? And as far as Ukraine is concerned, can Ukraine actually belong to have an eastern partnership with the EU and also belong to this Eurasian Union that Putin wants to set up?
And
Nicholas Arena, I'm a lawyer, and Scott Horton and I were part of a team that went to Central Asia years ago. Turkey was mentioned.
Yes.
Turkey has certain advantages because of the linguistic ties with the different stands. And Turkey has also been the traditional enemy of Russia. What do you suppose lies in the future with regard to any competition between Russia and Turkey in Central Asia?
Okay. Wow. Okay, so I guess, Dmitry, I'll give you the first go at the three questions then. So just to summarize the question about police reform, is a Georgian approach applicable in Kyrgyzstan? What fate for the Eurasian Union now and Ukraine's, and also Ukraine's place in that, and then Turkey-Russia relations when it comes to the region?
Well, on the police forces, I think this is probably too far outside of my area of expertise, since I both in terms I you know, I'm more focused on the region from looking at flows coming into the region rather than what's going on in the region, and more on the military than the police. So I'm not sure I know I have a good answer for what exactly would be involved or why, you know, some countries can do this effectively and not others. So I think I'll refrain from. I don't know if Scott has an answer. On the Eurasian Union, well, I think Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan would both sort of sought to get in and have so far been kind of
standoffish.
A little bit. Yeah, but the Russians have been standoffish, I mean. I'm not sure if that has to do with the recognition that these are not the most economically viable countries. So I think that sort of speaks a little bit to what I was saying about where Putin's mental map of integration, where the limits are. It may be that he's not that interested in too much integration. They're recognizing that it'd be more of a drain and a burden than a benefit for Russia. As for whether Ukraine can be in both, well, that was, if it could, then we wouldn't have had this whole mess. that part of the whole, and I'm not an economist, so I don't know if there are actually hard constraints that say you can't, I imagine that there are, because there are different rules in the different customs unions, it would probably be difficult. But regardless of that, the EU very clearly said we can't do that.
Right.
So from that point of view, that was an option foreclosed, even if there was some way to make it viable. And finally, on Turkey, that relationship has been very interesting in recent. Turkey and Russia have had a somewhat cooperative relationship over the last few years, but now we're seeing Turkey's being very kind of making some very strong statements defending Crimean Tatars, for example, clearly the sort of cultural affinities, or perhaps to put another way, the Crimean Tatar domestic constituency within Turkey, right, is putting enough pressure on Erdogan. So for one reason or another, those kinds of factors are overriding whatever economic cooperation benefits Turkey had been focused on previously. So far it hasn't gone beyond rhetoric.
Right.
And rhetoric, is relatively easy compared to cutting off, energy cooperation.
But
it could develop. It could develop. And Turkey, as far as Central Asia itself, Turkey has been, there were great hopes in the early 90s of, the great, the big brother kind of approach, which led to disappointment in Turkey. And after that, there were...
And in Central Asia.
Yeah. Well, in different ways, right?
Right.
But yes. And I think after that, they were much more circumspect in there. And but there's a lot of, rather than grand goals and pronouncements, it's much more kind of practical. Turkish construction companies dominate in a lot of Central Asia. Certainly in the marble palaces of Ashgabat, right, and elsewhere in Turkmenistan. And so I think that kind of practical cooperation is likely to continue. And it's not necessarily competing with Russia. It's more of a it's complementary in some ways again with Russia. Certain aspects of economic, Turkey is not as engaged on the security side as it were before, whereas they're more engaged maybe on the economic side.
Scott, anything you wanted to add to
that? I'll pick up the first question about police, but let me just back up and say, of course it starts with the corruption issue, as you noted, and it seems to me that this is actually one of the huge issues with Ukraine too that hasn't gotten as much analytical attention as it deserves, because I think one of the things we saw in Ukraine was the incredible ability of effective corruption allegations to delegitimize and bring down a government. It was the number one tool that was used against Yanukovych, and I have a very clear sense right now, though I think a lot of the governments involved don't want this to be reported or in the papers, I have a sinking suspicion it's going to be soon, the U.S., the Austrians, the Swiss, the Hungarians are working very closely right now with the new government in Kiev, trying to nail this down. I mean, there is a thesis that it's not just Yanukovych, it's the whole Rosukrenergo deal. Firtas, this Hungarian businessman who was arrested, by the way, recently in Austria, is involved. And these were all used, this was used as a tool by Moscow to try to destabilize, corrupt, and entangle Ukrainian politicians. And I think there's a big effort going on right now to get to the bottom of it. One of the problems that goes with these revolutions, though, especially ones where their people are shot, a delegitimizing of the police, right? And I think that happened in Kyrgyzstan in spades. I mean, I have to say, when I go there, just driving around the streets of Bishkek, I am scared witless sometimes by the lack of respect of the people to just traffic rules. Mm-hmm. They just don't care anymore. Correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I mean, to me, it's just like, and this wasn't the way things were before the revolution. And I think a lot of that is driven by lack of respect of the police. And that's one of the huge institutional problems of this third Kyrgyz Republic. And I think they urgently need to do something to shore up the respect and authority of the police. And I think the Georgians had a good program. So I think it's a plausible way for them to proceed. But in any event, they have a clear problem. And the Georgians had that same problem, too. The Eurasian Union issue, Dmitry's absolutely right about that. I mean, this is one of the things that was maybe the single most important issue that drove the Maidan demonstrations, is the perception of elites in Ukraine. I'm talking about business people, bankers, lawyers in Kiev, that they were at a crossroads right now. The country was either going to proceed towards a closening with the European Union, or it was going to do this deal with Russia, with the Eurasian Union, that would rule out further proximity to Europe. And I think in the view of most of these people, even Russian speakers, that was not a wise decision. And I think that's one thing that really drove it. And I think the question about Turkey, I think, is also very, very interesting. If you read Turkish press and you read remarks coming from Turkish politicians, it is getting, built up, being heated. We're also sort of in the pre-election mode there, and we've got a prime minister trying to distract from other matters. But yeah, I think I see, some possibility of Turkey becoming more assertive, but, it's a regional power at most. It's not going to do a lot. But economic interests are very, very strong, with Ukraine in particular.
Okay. Thanks. Further round of questions. So one, two for now. Okay. Three. Okay.
First of all, a little statement. I am really surprised how well you know Russia. Not only know, you really understand Russia. You feel Russia. I left this country 19 years ago, and when I talk with somebody who came from Russia, I understand and don't understand anything anymore. Because it's not just to get information. By the way, I always admire Harper. When I read, for example, Remnik, I jump. When he can compare Khodorkovsky to Brodsky, court to courts, and make comparison, that's almost the same. Now my question: why you believe that's crisis for America and for Russia? Russia, it seems to me, only benefit first time maybe, top and bottom of country really united, opposition, which always was a joke, very weak, now is nothing in Russia. Putin tremendously benefit from the situation in every possible way. And what America lost? Well, maybe several billions of dollars what Russian would took from America and would not invest in America. Not a big deal. But America would tremendously benefit from real enemy right now. After all, confusion in Afghanistan, in Iraq, medical care, political accusation of each other, now they have a real business to deal with. So it seems to me two sides just benefit from situation.
Thanks. Elise Giuliano, I teach politics at Columbia, professional politics. My question is about existing ties between Russia and maybe Kazakhstan and maybe Uzbekistan? Because if we think about this current conflict in the neo-imperial framework and Russia's motivation, then we're all talking about, you know, is Kazakhstan afraid of Russia making the same kind of move into Russia? And that's important to discuss. But if we think about Russia's behavior with Crimea as a kind of knee-jerk response to losing Ukraine and a kind of Putin's taking revenge on the affront of losing influence in such an important country, we could imagine that Putin is very concerned not to lose influence in Kazakhstan, so may want to work with, or in Uzbekistan, may want to work with those countries to prevent a similar opposition from forming or gaining popularity in those countries. So I'm wondering if, you know, you talked a little bit about the ways in which Russia works to prevent the Islamist opposition there from gaining ground. I wonder if there's existing relationships or existing flows that Russia could turn now toward really trying to prevent an opposition from emerging, well, the opposition that exists to a certain degree in Kazakhstan, from gaining strength or from working together with a nationalist opposition, and so may try to head off the growth of a popular movement to maybe overthrow or to expose corruption or whatever you have. So could you see a way in which Putin may say, I'm going to direct resources or aid or training to prevent that kind of opposition from emerging? And you know, and if so, like, what are the, in what exists now that he could easily shift toward that kind of policy?
And third.
To what extent is the Uyghur situation in China influencing China's perception of the region, if at all?
Great. Okay, so again, three questions then. So opportunities within the crisis between the U.S. and Russia at this point. Second, so whether or not...
Or is it a crisis,
right. Crisis or opportunity, I guess, or both. The question then also about whether or not Russia may direct its resources to preventing the emergence of opposition within the region, particularly in Kazakhstan, and so Uyghur issue in China's policy.
Okay, it is a crisis, and the reason why is because it's much broader than just the U.S. and Russia. I agree with you on the Russia, you know, this union of top and bottom and so forth. I'm not convinced that it's going to last very long because the glory of throwing off the humiliation of the breakup of the Soviet Union will last for a bit. But if the economy really gets bad, people will, you know, the glory will fade and the economic pain will come to the forefront, much as you know, everyone in Serbia united around Milosevic when the NATO was bombing Serbia, but that didn't prevent him from being tossed out through popular protests just a year or two later. So that's on the Russian side. I think Putin is kind of gambling with high stakes on this. And the danger is that having seen the effect of popular support for this kind of adventure, would he do something like this in the future if his support starts to decline? You know, do it somewhere else if the opportunity presents itself. So that's a danger. For the U.S., I think... You know, it's all fine to have rhetoric about a real enemy or whatever, but it's a confrontation with Russia does not actually help U.S. security in any way. Depending on how this plays out, if there's a continued serious confrontation, that having two countries with the largest nuclear weapons arsenals, et cetera, in confrontation is not a good thing for security. Even if it doesn't, it distracts from the issues that the U.S. was starting to focus on going forward, especially you know the rise of China, right? And we've already been distracted from the rise of China once by Islamic terrorism, where people have kind of forgotten that the Bush foreign policy for the first 6 months of his term was all about focusing on China, and then that kind of got derailed. And now Obama was also pivoting to Asia and so forth. So that I think is something also to keep in mind. As far as the larger crisis, the real crisis here is the threat to twofold. The threat to the whole notion of territorial integrity, right? I mean, this is a norm in international law that has, I think, done a lot for reducing conflict and maintaining stability. And to the extent that that is weakened is not a good thing. And two, the way it's been weakened by the scariest part of Putin's speech for me, for the parliament, was when he was talking about protecting ethnic Russians abroad. Because as we've discussed, there's many ethnic Russians all over the place that could be protected if circumstances arise. And what's more, there are lots of other people all over the world that could be protected by their neighbors of, you know, Chinese in Malaysia, or you know, all sorts of ethnic minorities in different parts of Africa belonging to neighboring states, supposedly, and Hungarians in Romania. I mean, there's just the examples are infinite, and that again, that idea, and it turns all those people into a potential fifth column, right? That even if nobody actually does anything, the governments of the countries where they live could start viewing them with distrust, and that could have very negative effects on human security. Elisa's question on I think they've already been doing this all along. I'm not sure if I didn't mean to imply what I was trying to say was that the rhetoric is about protecting these states from Islamic terrorism. That is a worry for them. I'm not saying that that's just a fig leaf, but it's always been a second part where maintaining regime stability against internal domestic opposition. I mean, that's why we see all of the Uzbek efforts to repress anyone who expresses opposition and brand them an Islamic terrorist while they're at it, whether or not they have any inclinations to that. And so I think that the cooperation with security services is already there. I don't know specifically. Uzbekistan is perhaps the most fraught relationship, but I'm sure that, you know, even as there are 10 ebbs and flows, there's still a level of cooperation there as well. But the other countries, I think it's much closer. Okay, and finally, Uyghurs. China's, I mean, this is one of the reasons that China's been so resistant to endorsing this move, I think, is that Uyghurs, Tibetans,
Taiwan.
I really thought that my initial thought after it was clear that Russian troops without insignia were in Crimea was that they were going to create a Taiwan, put Yanukovych in Crimea and have a one Ukraine policy. But that's not the direction they went in. But yeah, I think China is very cautious about any kind of weakening of this norm of territorial integrity, in part because of minorities in China and also because of Chinese minorities in other countries.
Scott, anything you want to...
I just come back, you know, to the question of crisis, you know. I mean, I think it's a fair question. Is this a crisis? What kind of crisis? It is right now, I think, a minor crisis. Is it a U.S.-Russia crisis? There's a tendency of certain parts of the media and certain political people to play it and pitch it that way. That seems to me fundamentally wrong in many different ways. I mean, you know, it is... The core of the crisis is... you know, the decision-making rights of people in Ukraine, this being a highly fragmented state. And it seems to me that responsible political management would aim at downplaying the possibility of broader international crisis, and particularly a militarization of the crisis, which is highly undesirable. And I think if you look at what Merkel has said, what Obama has said, I think there's a pretty broad consensus on the Western side that you know, it shouldn't be allowed to be turned into that sort of crisis. But in the end, it's also something that is in the course of development. And I think it, you know, were there to be mobilization of Russian troops in the territory of Ukraine beyond Crimea, I mean, that would transform it considerably. It would become much, much more acute at that point. But I think there's still a very firm resolve on the Western side that this is not going to be dealt with on a military level.
Yep.
And I think that's a very wise approach to things. With respect to Kazakhstan, I think, you asked the obvious question, but I think if you look very closely at Kazakhstani politics over the last 10 years, Russia plays smart, peripheral imperial interest politics. They've always done that. They've always had favorites who are in the, let's say, favored elite figures within Kazakhstan who are not necessarily on the friendliest terms with the president. And in more of you look at every single other country, it's the same thing. I mean, even in Tajikistan, where there's a government in place which is has the closest possible relationship, nevertheless, they absolutely shield and protect some of his major opposition figures in Moscow. And that has, obvious advantages to them. By the way, the U.S. does the same thing. It's smart politics to do that. But I think, in light of what's happened in Ukraine, it may take on a different aspect in the future. And finally, I think, Uyghur, I'm wondering, looking at what's going on in China right now, in light of this Kunming slashing incident, that's being really hyped in China. The government is playing it up, and I'm wondering if this is not going to lead to a more aggressive posture on the Chinese side for domestic security purposes, focusing on repression and control of Uyghur activists. And if so, and I suspect that is likely right now, although I don't see exactly how it's going to unfold, but one thing I think that is predictable is going to be a clampdown on Uyghurs in the Central Asia, abroad, but especially in the Central Asian region. So that'll be the major ask of the Chinese in dealing with these governments.
All right, on that uplifting note, we are actually at the end of our allotted time here. So I hope that Scott and Dmitry can hang around for a few more minutes. People have other questions. But first of all, I do want to take the opportunity to thank them both, Dmitry for this outstanding paper, and Scott for finding the time to come down and share your thoughts with us. So thank you, everybody.